If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org. Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks for making your way here, for checking out the episodes. Hit that subscribe button if you're not already. You're going to get new interviews just like this one every single week. You can grab us at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And please do give the series a rating and leave a review wherever you're listening from right now. Those always help out so much. We've had some great guests drop by. Elvira was here, Cassandra Peterson herself. We talked with Olivia Allen Lind about the series Wayward on Netflix. Jeff Tweedy, lead singer of Wilco, dropped by. Mary Stuart Masterson, Rob Cordery, and Michael Chiklis were all here to talk about the movie The Senior. Hannah Stocking, Madison Pettis, and Yvonne Orji, they're all starring in The Wrong Paris on Netflix. Willem Dafoe, legendary Hollywood actor, along with Curry Hawkins. We talked with both of them about The Man in My Basement, Soft Cell, OMD, Lizzie Hale, Sabrina Impeccatore. It's what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. That's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, it's going to be a special Rewind episode with two of the sharpest pens to ever strum an acoustic. Colin Hay, who once ruled MTV with Men at Work before finding a second life as your favorite sad, funny troubadour on Scrubs soundtracks. And Bruce Coburn, the Canadian poet warrior who can go from protest chants to finger-picking spirituals without breaking a sweat. One has the hits that everyone whistles without knowing who wrote them. The other has the songs that critics call essential and you'll feel guilty for not already having in your playlist. Together, they're the guys who proved singer-songwriters don't have to be coffeehouse wallpaper. They can cut you to the bone, still make you laugh before that last chord even fades. We're going to start out with Colin Hay. My first conversation with Colin stretches back to 2012 when I met him backstage at Bonnaroo. That's where we got to talk about comedy and tragedy, second chances, living in the present, his father, and not being the oldest guy at the festival. So this is part one of today's special Rewind episode. This is Kyle Meredith With Colin Hay.
Bonnaroo 2012, the weekly feed, Kyle Meredith and the one and only Colin Hay. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. There is another Colin Hay. I think he's a scientist.
Yes, this is the only you. I'm still going to go by that. I don't care about him. In my mind, man does not exist.
I don't
care
about him either.
Yeah, there we go. Hope he's watching this. You hear that, Colin Hay, other? Bonnaroo usually kind of tries to put a wow moment on every year, and there were a couple of them this year, but I think you, for me, was the wow moment, because it was like, okay, not only are you singing, but you're performing in the comedy tent.
And am I the oldest person here?
Are you the oldest person here?
The oldest person.
You know, the Beach Boys are here, you know?
There you go.
Beach Boys, they got
Alice,
you.
Alice, he's probably older than me,
he's
right? Actually, there's a lot of people who are older than me here.
See? Young at heart. How did you end up at the comedy tent?
Well, you know, I've been playing for the last 25 years after the band broke up, mm-hmm. and I play songs, and then in between the songs I tell stories and I try and entertain the folks, and sometimes I'm funny and sometimes I'm not, but you know, somebody saw me from the books Bonnaroo at one of the shows I did, and he thought that I'd be good for the comedy tent, you know, so, and I went on after Garfunkel and Oates,
which is
you know, they say that there's three things you shouldn't do in entertainment, and that's follow children, animals, or Garfunkel and Oates. But they're awesome. But no, I was fine. Yeah. It was good. It was good, and I enjoyed myself. And
did you have to change anything up? I mean, did you have to think about, like, for the first time you had to work on a comedy bit? I mean,
no.
Does funny become natural?
No,
to
I didn't.
You?
I did nothing. I did nothing.
Yeah.
To change my act at all. I just did this.
That's confidence.
I just did the same old stuff.
That's confidence right there.
And I thought, hey, it worked yesterday, it's going to work today.
No, that works so well. I notice most comedians, though, as they talk about it, people, you know, go for funny because they had such crappy childhoods and, you know, they hated their... Did you have to get to that dark place for your humor?
No, well, my childhood was great. I have no complaints about my childhood. I'm really, very lucky in that sense. But then again, I'm not a comedian.
Nah. Way to play that one down. That's nice. That's nice. Well, now, there's lots going on. I know, you know, speaking of those early years, too, you're celebrating the 30th anniversary of that debut record.
Well, I'm not celebrating it, really, because I lost Greg Hamm about a month ago. So it's not really, there's nothing really for me to celebrate. Mm. But, I mean, it is 30 years, but it doesn't, to be honest, it doesn't really mean anything to me.
So you're not big into the nostalgia, you don't go back?
No, I don't really look back that much.
Yeah. What is it, kind of a monument?
I don't really look forward that much either. I just, you know, here
right
we are,
here
Kyle.
It is. Yeah, right here it is.
Right here, right now.
I'm honored that right now I'm the most important part of your day, because it's happening right now.
Well, that's right. We're in the present moment, and we have to live in the moment. Oh, hang on, that moment's gone.
Right,
now we're in another moment.
Well, I think somebody said you can live forever as long as you're living in the present.
I think that's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to live by that. That's very, very wise. Yeah, wise beyond your years, Kyle.
You're welcome. If you take anything away from this, if you remember Bonnaroo 2012, it's going to be that line.
That's right.
Chris, you won't remember because you won't be looking back.
That's right. It'll be in that moment.
No, it is a testament that you have stayed in the music industry this long and you have done so much. I mean, you know, for however long it's been, you know, the 30 years or whatever.
I think it's very kind of you to call it an industry.
Well, it's a bit out there at this point. The tentacles have spread out a bit.
Yeah.
And
I feel more like a traveling salesman.
Do you?
Yeah, because I just go around and I don't take, you know, things out of a suitcase and, you know, with a vacuum cleaner, but, you know, play the songs and entertain the folks. But that's what I feel closer to more than anything else. But I've been around for a while, and I have beautiful fans, and everyone says that, and probably everyone means it, but I really, after I got dropped by major record labels in the early 90s, all I did was I played acoustic guitar and sang, and sometimes I had a band, sometimes not. But the thing was always really growing, and that really kept me going in a nourishing kind of way, was the fans, because they came along and they kind of got what I was doing.
Right.
So it was complete. It was an end in itself. It didn't require any radio or record labels.
Right.
It was just like, okay, here's a gig, and so it's been developing from that. So that's really all I've got, and it's dear to me, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, you got a second life out of that, of course.
Exactly.
Last decade, how you came back. Was there ever a point where you thought, I could shed my old persona now? I don't have to play the three songs or whatever.
Well, there was a time in the 80s when the band broke up where I kind of, a little bit like divorce, you kind of think, oh, well, I didn't feel. But, you know, the songs are the things that stay with you. You know, the songs are the things that have been kind to you, and they're the things you came up with. So they're precious. The songs never go away. And, you know, personnel changes and so forth. But no, music's beautiful in that sense. Did you ask a question there? Or
well,
not?
No, I think you answered it. You know, you don't have to get rid of that history and everything.
It's dangerous. I mean, some people do want to, you know, but it's part of who you are. So it's like, you know, a lot of people don't play songs and that were famous for them because they have they get sick of them.
Yeah.
But you can let songs go through constant rebirths, you know. It depends on how much you put into it. You know, whenever I play those songs, I love it. You know, just because they can be fresh. They're as fresh as you want them to be.
Right.
You know, you're really in control of it.
Yeah. Well, you've made some beautiful records over the years. The solo records, everything. Gathering Mercury, of course. I know it was written under dark times.
Yeah. Well, also that's, you know, my father died a couple of years ago, and I wrote that song. I wrote that album after that. But in a lot of ways, it was a selfish thing because it was a way of keeping him. It was a way of bringing him back. You know, it wasn't really so much writing songs about the fact that he was dead. It was writing songs that were inspired while he was alive, you know, because he was a very alive man, you know, and you know, he had a music shop in Scotland. And so, when I was growing up, talking about childhood, you know, between the age of 5 and 14, I had surrounded by records and guitars and drums and pianos. My father played me the Beatles and stuff. Beautiful time, you know, really good.
Yeah, well, it's a great way to do it and everything. With the whole acoustic stuff, do you think you could ever do the pop thing again? You know?
Well, I always think that.
Because what do you think, what do you call yourself, a folk artist now?
I don't really call myself anything, really. I just
you call yourself college.
I mean, I make records, and I don't think they're acoustic albums because they've got drums and loud things on them. You know, I still think that I'm a pop singer.
Yeah. Well, you're a great singer regardless, so.
You know, I may be deluding myself, but I don't care.
No, I like the way you say pop singer. It's almost like, you know, in the crooner years.
That's right, a pop singer. Yeah, exactly.
It's called Hey in the Vegas Years.
That's right. So. Well, my father used to sing my songs to me, too. He used to croon them.
He used to sing your songs back to you.
I can't get to sleep. Yeah, on the way to the airport in the car. I couldn't get away.
That's fantastic, and kind of weird in a weird way, but it worked for you. It is a pleasure. It is so much a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for all the years you've given us so
far,
and then all the ones yet to come.
Okay, so. This has been good for my basal cell at the end of my nose there.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith. Special Rewind episode. We still have my conversation with Bruce Coburn to come, but going to feature the second time I talked with Colin Hay first. So the first time was in 2012. The second time, 5 years later, it was 2017. He was talking about his solo release, Fierce Mercy, and we got to talk also a documentary about his life that came out that year. This is part two, Kyle Meredith with Colin Hay.
Hey there.
You're a very busy man suddenly right now, it seems. Even busier than usual.
Yeah, busier than usual. Yeah, it came upon me the day or two ago. I thought exactly the same thing. I thought, I'm quite busy at the moment. It's a little too busy. But, you know, you take it when it comes, you know. And sometimes it's not busy. But most of the time for the last couple of decades, I've been busy, really.
Yeah. Well, what we're talking about here, I mean, it's almost simultaneous, right? You've got a new album and a documentary about your life.
Yeah, and that was kind of... That wasn't necessarily really planned that way. It kind of happened that way, you know, that the record was ready to come out. And the people who were running the documentary side of things, they were trying to get a deal for it, you know, and it kind of finally happened. And then these people said, well, you know, we've got it ready to go. And so it kind of seemed synchronistic to combine them in some way, you know.
So this record, you know, I heard the first single. It is a beautiful song, A Thousand Million Reasons. I mean, you've got this amazing knack for writing love songs. You always have.
Yeah, it came out really well. I was very happy with that song. My songwriting partner came up with the music for it, and he on a Sunday, I think, he said, look, come over, I've got this musical idea, and he played it for me on this old kind of 80s octagon thing that he was playing with, kind of an instrument that Mattel made, and anyway it was a really beautiful piece, but he was playing it quite fast and quite jaunty, you know. And as soon as he played it, I thought, oh, this would be really good slowed down. So came up with the words, and then we recorded it. And then I asked Fred Cron, who's a musician friend of mine, I thought it'd be nice orchestrated, and you know, one thing led to another, and the song kind of just really started to bloom a little bit, you know. So we just followed that, and it ended up being quite the piece, you know, when we put strings on it. So it's I love it. It's a cool tune.
Yeah. And it's instantly one of my favorites that you've done. And I related really quickly to the beginning of it too, because one of my, I think, greatest memories of my life was flying into Paris, and I was the only one awake in the plane, and I kind of pull the window up just as the sun is rising over France.
And there you go.
One of the most beautiful sights ever. So when you're talking about that at the beginning, I don't know, is that just lyrical poetry for you, or is that anything based on fact?
I was, when I went over to Michael's house, he said, can you write some lyrics for this musical piece? I just picked up a magazine, and the first photograph was the sun coming up over Paris.
And there it is, right there for you.
So I thought, well, there you go. It's just, you know, write what's in front of you.
It's very lucky to have that just sitting there.
Yeah, well, sometimes you miss it, you know. Sometimes there's things, you know, as they say, hiding in plain sight, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm kind of reading a little bit about this record, and I saw that one of the quotes you said, it's sort of an album, songs from being a certain age, which I didn't know exactly what that might have meant.
Well, I'm not really sure, but I think that both Michael and I, when we're writing the songs, we're kind of, he's a little bit older than me, but we just have that, when we're downstairs writing these tunes, we're kind of, we are of a certain age, you know, physically, and we're kind of, you feel the pressure of time, because you know, you can visualize the future, you know, if you think about the last 20 years, it's quite easy to imagine, to remember and to imagine 20 years, because, you know, it's easy to do because the last 20 years went by pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And so I think about how old I am and I think, well, you know, maybe on a good day, and if I look after myself, you know, I maybe got about that much time left, and you think, well, fuck, I better get on with it, you know, and do whatever I want to do and, you know, enjoy myself and have, you know, have fun and all the things that you want to do with your life. I'm not, you know, it's almost like I don't really have any idea about retirement. You know, I've never really considered that, you know, because I haven't really had a job where you think, oh, well, one day you'll retire from this. I just kind of, you know, I'm trying to avoid working for the last 40 years, you know, in the straight world, you know. So this is basically, you know, what I'm doing now. Even if you retire, you still kind of do it. So we're downstairs working away, and you know, you're still kind of trying to, you still feel like you're 26 or 27. You're trying to, you know, come up with your version of Rubber Soul or Bring It All Back Home or whatever album you care to mention that you love, you know. So you are a certain vintage, a certain age, but you always, at some point, you just kind of, the inspiration remains, you know, for what it is that you've always done. So you kind of, you are a certain age, but you still have, I guess, you're just somewhat starry-eyed, you know, about the world, you know, and I think that's a valuable thing. So that's what it felt like to us, was that there was something both, you know, considered about the songs, but also something which was still, some, hopefully anyway, a sense of wonder about them, you know?
Yeah, I've never understood the whole, when a musician announces they're retiring, like I can understand retiring from the road because that's hard. But, you know, as a creative person, like, you know, I mean, hell, Tony Bennett's still doing it. He's in his 90s, you know. He's about to go on another tour, so...
Yeah, he's an extraordinary person, isn't he? Just a really extraordinary man. I've never met him, but he seems like, a really extraordinary person, you know?
Yeah.
Very, very creative and smart and really kind of, you know, there's a pragmatic aspect to it as well. He's like, I've got to keep working,
yeah.
You know, because he's got that thing. Well, you know, you don't stop working, because if you stop working, then people forget about you, you know?
Yeah. And I always figured, as long as you can do it, what's the alternative? I mean, you get bored at some point.
Yeah.
I don't know, unless you want to, you know, hog farm or something. I don't know, but.
Yeah. And there is that thing of just, I always kind of make a joke of it, but it's, you know, you've had breakfast, you know, now what?
Yeah, right. the day's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, you got to do something, you know? Yeah. You're all dressed up. You put your clothes on.
Well, I want to hear about this documentary a little bit, though. I mean, you know, I see the guys approached you with it. They kind of brought the idea to you, and it's a great way to tell a story. I don't know. I mean, had you ever thought of doing the other side? Because this seems much easier than writing a book.
Yeah, I've actually started the book. I started the book a number of years ago, and then I just stopped. I feel terrible about it, because I actually have a, you know, a deal for it. It's not a you know, deal that involves any money or anything. But I basically a lunch and a promise that I would deliver this book, and I haven't, and I feel awful because it's, you know, kind of a good publisher, and I started it and I was really into it, and then. I don't know what I know my mother died. My mother died about, you know, 3.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I couldn't do it. I would sit down to try and write stuff and I just wasn't into it. And I'll get back to it. But it was around that time that these guys approached me and said, they had this treatment and said, do you want to, you know, do some filming? So it seemed fortuitous.
You could just transcribe the entire documentary at this point and say, there you go, there's your book.
I suppose, you know, I was into it. I was kind of into the writing process and kind of trying to actually trying to figure out how you could write something about, you know, one's life or things which just made it different somehow. From other books you read in a similar thing, but and then this happened and then this happened, you know. It was more about my approach at the time anyway, was about very much the present, was letting the present day, say, for example, if you're in a particular tone, you know, really let that letting that inform the story of keeping it present, you know, like almost like a diary.
Mm-hmm.
But letting the present day inform the past, you know, because often you're repeating yourself. Often you're present somewhere, and then the past reveals itself, you know. But in making it like that rather than kind of too linear, you know, and orderly. But anyway, hopefully I'll get back to it at some point.
It sounds really cool. I hope you do. As far as the movie, though, I mean, that's your life in moving pictures. Were there any, I don't know, startling realizations that you'd looked over, or moments of, did that really happen?
It was more, because I've kind of traveled, you know, in relative secrecy, you know, for the last couple of decades, I have fans who've come to see me play, and I've, you know, done records and all that kind of stuff, but as far as the, you know, if you want to call the general public a concern, it's, you know, once you're not, you seem to, you often the attitude is, oh yeah, that, what happened to that guy, or what happened to that band, you know, it's a little bit like people don't really pay attention to, you know, in any great mm-hmm. in any detail to what you're doing, and why should they? I mean, they've got their own lives, you know. I mean, someone like yourself, because you're involved in, or you're interested, you know, people who are interested pay attention, but for the most part, most people don't. So it was good in that sense, that at least you go, okay, well, this is filmed, and it's a document of the fact that, you know, you have been doing stuff, and you do still exist, really, and you're still doing things that hopefully are useful in some way, you know. So I quite like that aspect of it, you know, that it's not that it's there for people, it exists, you know, and which is kind of some kind of affirmation of the work you've been doing, you know, in a way. So I was happy about that. But, you know, it's a snapshot, you know, of what's happened. You know, there's always things that, you know, you get a bit of what you've been doing. And I think that the more they started to film, the more they realized that of this, the bigness of the story, in a way, or even just the fact that it's more of a common tale than you'd imagine, you know, having a lot of success and then that going away. And then what do you do after that? How do you deal with the rest of your life? So I think that these guys, they'd come to see me play, and they liked the solo show, and they liked the solo songs and all that, and they wanted to, you know, expose that to a wider audience. But the more they filmed, and the more involved they got, the more they realized that the backstory had never really been told very well. You know, the whole Men at Work story was a band that was immensely successful, then it just kind of virtually just disappeared, you know. So they got caught up in that as well, which became more a part of the story the more, you know, the longer they filmed.
Yeah, and that interesting when any time, especially in music, as we look back on any artist who had any level of fame, it's always this little bitty part of their life. I mean, even when you take the Beatles, what is that, 7-8 years, and...
Yes.
And I think Van Morrison said something to that ilk, too. He was like, you know, everybody wants to concentrate on about 3 or 4 years. He goes, I've done so many things in the 80s, in the 90s, you know. There's so many stories, mm-hmm. and yet that's the part that everybody wants right there. That's the hook,
yep.
I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I did some stuff yesterday, and it's amazing. People still say to me, so what is Vegemite? You know, and you think to yourself, you know, it's kind of, they all think it's funny and stuff, and it's I mean, on one level it is, but you think to yourself, why would they think that would be a question that you'd really want to hear, you know, 40 years later, you know. And also, they've probably got a computer, you know?
Turn the question back around on them. Ask what they did 40 years ago on this one day.
You know, that's the point of reference. I don't really mind. It's not right. Something that is upsetting at all. You know, but mm-hmm. I mean, the thing about that was those things happen to me. You know, and you're involved in it. You know, you're part of it, and that's something that you really that relationship you have with yourself is the really important, exciting one, because I was there when those things happened, and that never leaves you. It never in a lot of ways it never leaves you. That whatever happened, whether you're the first time you came to New York or the first time you played here or the first time you did that, it's all just so present. It doesn't really feel like part of the past, so it's something that, when people say, oh, he was once this, he was once that, you're always that. It's as present now as it ever was. It's not something that you think, oh, that's a, go back into that room, and reminisce about those days. It's not something that I ever really do, because right. It's really just, it's right there in front of me. All I've got to do is remember it and think about it. And I go, oh yeah, that's part of, it's part of me. It's inside you,
Yeah. That's a great way to deal with it, and a good mantra to have. I got to run, and I'll let you run too. Really love the new record. Nice talking to you, Colin. Take care.
Bye.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. Now time for part three. This goes at, well, it's still in 2017. In fact, it was a month after that Colin Hay interview that I jumped on the line with the legendary Bruce Cockburn. He had just released his 25th album at that time, called Bone on Bone. We got to talk about that, his autobiography, the intersection of politics and religion, and a whole lot more. Part three of this Rewind. This is Kyle Meredith with Bruce Cockburn.
Hi, Kyle. It's Bruce Cockburn here.
Let's see. First off, I should congratulate you, actually, because the whole Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame, that's a big thing. I mean, I feel like you were a shoe-in for a long time, so maybe it's more surprising that it took this long, but congratulations.
I don't know. I thank you very much. It's a nice thing for sure. It's not something I spend very much time thinking about, honestly. But I mean, that kind of stuff is a part of the music scene that I don't pay much attention to. But it's nice to be recognized for sure. And I think we'll probably have a pretty good evening.
I'm probably painting it more than you would care for. But it's sort of like getting the crown on the career. Not that your career is even anywhere near finished, but it's a nice crown on top of it, just the same.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't mean you're supposed to be dead. that's the catch with Halls of Fame. It's like, aren't you supposed to be like over with by then? But anyway, it is nice, and I'm over that, so it's fine.
Yeah, well, I think the same could be said about the memoir, because it's sort of the interesting thing. You have your memoir out of the way now, yet your life still goes on. There's still more story after the end or whatever.
Yeah, and if my hands fail me at some point, maybe I can write volume two.
Yeah.
We'll see. We did leave it as kind of open for that, because it ends, that story ends in 2010.
Yeah.
Just when I was getting ready to move out here, or had just moved out here. So actually getting ready to, because I think the book ends about the time I get back from Baghdad, which was, that's it now, even earlier, 2004. Oh. This is an aside, we don't have to go there, but there'll be more story to tell at some point if I have the brain and the energy left to tell it.
Does it seem in a way, though, that kind of cleans the slate in any way, getting the story out there like that? Is there any sort of reset?
I wouldn't say it that way. I mean, I think what there was a certain satisfaction in having kind of put it all, let's say aspects of it all, because, I mean, there's obviously a lot of stuff that happened in my life up to the point I wrote the book that isn't in the book. I mean, just because, the book would be like thousands of pages long instead of the 600 that it is. But it was satisfying to put it together in that way and have it, kind of the story of my growing spiritual understanding, I suppose, is really what it is. To have that cataloged up to date, I've always felt like, without really feeling like, I don't have an ego attachment to this idea, but it's always felt to me like part of the songwriting job for me was to leave a trail of whatever it is to grow as a human, both spiritually and in terms of intellectual understanding and all that sort of stuff. And the songs are kind of that trail. And so the book is a way of consolidating it into, something. I suppose you could say if anybody didn't get it in the songs, they'll get it in the book, because it's explicit, And it says, somebody described the book, I think, I don't know if it's more of the blurbs about it or if somebody just said it, but it's kind of a chronicle in a way of one person's experience of the second half of the 20th century. And I think in a certain sense, my experience, while it's individual to me, is representative of a lot of other people's experience too. So I think there's something to be shared there.
And that journey towards spirituality, and I know that goes into this record a lot as well, on Bone on Bone, you know, spirituality and a bit of, you know, what's happening in the world that I call the era that we're in at the moment. It's nice not to use the name sometimes. But, you know, and, you know, you're here in America. You probably have realized far before this moment that a lot of times religion sort of gets lumped in with the right side, the right wing of things, for politics, for whatever. Well, there's a lot of reasons. But, you know, for you, it seems like there might have to be a balance of trying to work in spirituality and politics, or is there? Do you have to try too hard on that?
I don't, actually. I think it's important to pay attention to the potential for confusion there. Really, really important. But for me, you know, I have my emotional reaction, immediate reaction to the stuff that comes down the pipe about, you know, who said what and who's going to do what and all that in the political arena. But I have a response to that that I feel. But in the bigger picture, that my understanding of what politics is supposed to be about, it's really based on my spiritual understanding, and an essential part of that is that we're supposed to love with one another and treat each other with compassion. And if you start there, it changes. It's going to change your views on a lot of political stuff. People get all worked up over a confusion between religious principles and social custom, and between religious principles and their own anger that we all carry with us from whatever source. And that sometimes, you know, is expressed in a mass way, as we can see around us now in, you know, in various quarters, and certainly throughout history. I mean, you know, this identifying religion with the state isn't a new thing, that we're identifying it with a powerful personality or identifying it with your own fear. I mean, this history's full of examples of this in all religions. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to be very wary of that kind of connection between faith and politics. But I think it's really, I think if you come at it from the angle of compassion and attempting to understand what motivates people, then, you know, it gives you a healthier perspective, at least. It also makes you feel somewhat helpless because there's such an avalanche of the other stuff.
Right. Well, still beautifully said, though. And so when this happens, when anything big in politics is happening, like it is happening right now, you know, a lot of people do turn to artists, sure, but there's also sort of an expectant, you know, like, oh, this is what's going to be in music. But I get the feeling from what I've read about you going into this record that you never tried for that.
I never have. It's always felt to me, I don't really think about it that much. It's just do the next thing. So, you know, I mean, there are songs that were written with a considerable degree of intentionality, let's say, but I don't remember ever sitting down saying, okay, now I got to write a song on this topic. Well, actually, I have to qualify that slightly. There, once in a while, I've been invited to write a song for a particular purpose, like a film, say, mm-hmm. and then of course you're operating with a different, coming at it from a different angle. But normally, for me, it's just a wait for the next idea, and the next idea is likely to spring from an emotional response, a strong emotional response to something I encounter, whatever it is, and it could be anything. Yeah. So, you know, this album is a lot about spirituality. It's a lot about being a person in this kind of what appears to be an increasingly crazy world. And so, you know, I mean, when I say it like that, it sounds like these are big themes, capital T, that are there. But really, the songs are personal to me the same way all my songs have always been.
One of those I'll actually point out with sort of all of that in mind is Three Alpertys, because as I get, you know, especially from the press release, which was very helpful, they're not always, but they were this time. You know, there was a moment because of the time spent between the last record, writing the book and everything in between, where you had doubted if you were going to be able to go on musically. And it was a tribute, right, to Al?
Alpertys was a Canadian poet. He died in, I think, 2000. And he was of my dad's generation. I think they were born the same year, 1918. And he was a brilliant poet, a brilliant Canadian poet, and really in a way, I mean, it might be a little bit of you had to be there, but if you were to read his stuff as a non-Canadian, you might not get this aspect of it, but he really radiates the soul of Canada. It's a lot of his poetry does anyway. It also has a kind of universal application the way stuff of the heart does, but it's very Canadian. It's very, very strong writing. And I hadn't really gotten into him very deeply. I was aware of him, but then, as you said, I was going through this period after I wrote the memoirs. I had spent 3 years writing in that and not writing anything else. So there were no new songs, and I thought, well, maybe songwriting's over. Maybe I'm supposed to write volume two of the book instead or something, you know, start writing journalism. But the songs did start coming, and one of the triggers to that was being invited to contribute a song to a documentary film that was being made about Al Purdy. And it was the intent behind that was to raise awareness, you know, among the public about him and his place in this sort of Canadian literary scene. And a bunch of us were invited to contribute songs, and it just came at a perfect time for me to, because by saying yes to it, then I had to get down and write something. It was going to be the Kickstarter to getting back into songs if it worked, and luckily for me it did. So I came up with this notion, thinking about Purdy's poetry and just thinking about him as a kind of character. The character in the song is not him, of course, but I just imagined this homeless guy who's obsessed with. I see a lot of homeless guys in San Francisco. You know, they're really a lot. So, you know, it was easy to picture. There's this guy on the street corner apparently ranting, but actually reciting Al Purdy's poetry. And so I just pictured this guy, and I thought the line came to me: "I'll give you three Al Purdy's for a $20 bill." So that gave birth to the song, then, and the song gave birth to the rest of the song. So I was very happy about that.
Yeah, I'm so happy those songs came. I don't mind saying that you've really done one of your finest albums, and for number 33, that's crazy. You know, it's a heck of a catalog you got there.
Well, I hope people appreciate it, and you know, I'm looking forward to getting out and touring with the songs. That's the exciting thing. And it does seem, I mean, 33 albums, for crying out loud. Although, you know, I was reading in Glenn Campbell's obituary, and he made, 70 albums or something?
Well, you so got time I guess still.
Well, if I last as long as he did, I've got what, 9 years to get the rest of them done. It would be a tall order.
Well, I look forward to all 40 some odd albums that you still got to come out. So I'll be listening.
Okay,
Bruce, it was really, really a pleasure talking to you, and thank you so much for this record too.
Nice to talk to you too, Kyle. All the best to you.
You too. Take care, man.
All right. Bye bye.
And there you have it, Bruce Coburn, Colin Hay. Thanks to both. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button if you're not already before you get out of here. That way you get new interviews just like this one every single week. New ones and old ones sometimes too. Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or again, anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With, and please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org. where I do a show Monday through Friday starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. It's 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music and bonus interviews and lots of music news as well. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from U2, The Spin Doctors, Alabama Shakes, Robin Hitchcock, Radiohead, Cowboy Junkies, Indigo Girls, Aaron Stevens, Nicole Atkins, Nathaniel Rateliff, Matthew Sweet, and my interviews with Ani DeFranco, Mitski, and Tamara Taylor. That's what you get when you tune in to weeknights starting 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always at Kyle Meredith. I hope you do like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.